back, WNST, Tassin Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are into the summer months. I'm into my Chicken Palooza outfit. And, of course, we got to eat all the Taharka ice cream here before it starts to melt, Don Mahler. Don had a case sent over to his place in Catonsville. I'm working on case number two, so I have lots of empty cartons made in Baltimore with love, just like Baltimore Positive. Last time we got together with this guy, there were crab cakes and there were chicken and waffles and there was State Fair and there was Fadley's and there were no masks, and I actually got to fist bump him, handshake him, elbow bump through the whole thing, Don Mahler. But times have changed since the last time we got together with the Senate President, right?
My goodness. I said off the air to the Senate President, it seems like it was 10,000. It's been 10,000 lifetimes, but man. It's a pleasure to welcome back the president of the Maryland State Senate, Senator Bill Ferguson from the 46th District. Senator, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you both and talk about changing times. This is something that nobody could have ever expected, but we are in an extraordinary moment.
Well, the pandemic handbook was not handed out when you were a school teacher or, at any point in your political career. Do you have any sort of report card on this in the early going? Because as I've sat here on my couch and watched the leader of the free world talk about injecting bleach and various other things, the realities are now we're in July. Don wants to see a baseball game. You know, I want football back. We all want our kids back to school. I'm not feeling great about where we are in that battle, and certainly, it's changed the way you've had to sort of structure your life as well.
I think every facet of life has changed, and I'll tell you, from the very beginning of this, well, going into the Senate President role, I often have joked since taking it on that I followed somebody that had been in the position for 33 years. There's no guidebook or template for how to follow somebody who's run an institution for 33 years. And then you take the major issues that we had coming up, Kerwin, HBCUs, Preakness, you name it, that was all on the table. And then you threw a pandemic on top of it. This has been a 6-month period of time that I never, ever, ever could have expected. But you know what? You play with the cards you're dealt. And I, from the very beginning, was of the mindset that the pandemic experience would be something that we would look back on 5, 10, 20 years from now and say, that was a moment when society changed. That I just had this sense back in March that we were walking into something really monumental. And I think that what we've seen with the Black Lives Matter protests, with sort of the unrest and uncertainty around equity in, it's all connected. I think they all are a part of this bigger narrative where the pandemic has really shown a light on structural problems that have been in our foundation, but that we glossed over too often, and it sort of forced us to look at our lives differently. And so I think that's what we're experiencing. And these are moments of serious consequence. That there are really important choices ahead that will define who we are as people for decades to come. And so that's a lot of responsibility, but it also means that we have a chance to do some really big things and really redefine our future. And I think so long as we can get through the next few months, and certainly I, of course, care deeply about what happens in November, because I think that will send a large message about where we as a country are going. I think this is a moment of reckoning that will lead to a very different future.
Well, Bill, picking up on that, there's so much in there. As you said, the world may never, ever be the same. I mean, it's, we talk, I know way back when we talked to university presidents, we said, we always talked about there was a pre-9/11 world mm-hmm. and a post-9/11 world. It does feel increasingly like now there may be a pre-pandemic world and a post-pandemic world. Yeah, let's get away from politics for a minute, because you're a dad, and you're raising young children. What do you think about in your quiet moments about the world 10 or 15 years from now for them? Talk to us as a dad and not as a Senate President.
It depends on the moment, honestly. There are moments where I have moments of sheer terror of what are my kids walking into, and what does the world look like after this, and what happens to the education? And I say this as a person, you know, speaking from a place of enormous privilege, where we have access to resources. We have been better off than a lot of folks, and I know how deeply challenging this experience has been as a parent, and I can't imagine what a number of single parents and grandparents and foster parents are and how they're facing these challenges. I mean, it has just been unbelievably monumental. But I think it will define who we are and what's really important. You know, I will say something that I keep going back to during this experience, you know, life was moving incredibly fast, and it still is, but there's a difference where we've had more family dinners with the four of us than we'd had for their entire lives aggregated. You know, I get to spend time during bedtime to read books, and we're reading Harry Potter right now with our soon-to-be third grader. Those were things that oftentimes, because things were going so quickly and I was out and about, that I sort of, you know, you knew were important, but you don't feel it. And now it's really made me focus in and remember that this is the stuff that really matters, that there's a core, and that everybody is feeling this way, that we have to get back to those things that make us who we are as people, and that make, you know, life on Earth so special. And so that's something that I will, there are a lot of challenging moments, but there's also been moments that have really made me focus in on the things that matter most, about kind of family and love and how to draw on loved ones and family for strength.
Well, and I think things move a little bit from the last time we were together, right? Last time we were together, you're looking forward to this challenge, and you've got it laid out as to the things you want to get done as an elected official, and, you know, realizing those dreams. And then, you know, the road sort of scatters a little bit back around March 15th, I think, for everybody. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, Senate president and all of those things really, really change professionally. As far as, I guess, where all the elbow grease needed to go for politicians and for all of us to figure out our Zoom, figure out how we're going to feed people. I mean, all of these very, very basic sort of, you know, after a natural disaster sort of planning across the whole spectrum of society.
Yeah, and I would say what's different about this experience, I mean, everything about a pandemic is unnatural. You know, humans are built to be in community. Right, that is who we are built as communal beings. And so to get through a pandemic, we have to kind of go against everything that makes us who we are. We have to stay far apart. We have to wear masks to not see each other. We can't be in close proximity. And so we're really fighting against these natural instincts. And I think that is a large reason of this angst and unease as this draws on. You know, we're really going against kind of human nature. But the good news is it will end. There will be a vaccine. There will be a point in which life is different. And so I think the key is keeping sort of hope alive during these very, very challenging times that we can sort of reimagine a different future. And I believe it also gives us a moment to pause and think about what is most important right now. We have to reprioritize what we once thought pre-COVID were the core things that were, you know, had to get done. I think we've all started to go through this period of reassessment to say, all right, we may need to get back to basics and really start thinking about how do we treat each and every one of us with dignity and respect and focus on those foundational things that make the public sector work. So, I think that something that the pandemic has forced us to do is reprioritize what is most important for the future. We had a lot of ideas and things out there that seemed so critical and important in the moment that now over the last 3 months where we've been in this sort of great pause of reassessing, we're going to come out of this and have to focus on some of our foundational principles. We got to focus on what can the public sector do to make sure that we have a proper safety net in place, that people are treated equally and justice is equitable for all. And then we have to make sure that the private sector does its job in a way that everybody can be a part of inclusive progress. We'd really kind of gotten away from the foundation of what makes us great. And I think, you know, we have the opportunity when we get through this to to reimagine a different future.
Well, I guess the core right here, right, is housing, education, employment, right? And we look at those three things and say those are always needs, but when unemployment's down in the country, but you look at where housing is and people's ability to pay their mortgage, and then we've talked at length with one of your peers and Brooke Learman to the fact that people have landlords who may be small, regular people like me that have a second or third place in a mortgage. Then you have education. Are we going to send these kids back to school? And then the employment part of this mass unemployment and what that means to all the rest of it, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is where I think that we really, especially after November, have to really think about what does a grand new deal look like? How do we get, you take sort of what we experienced as a country in the 30s, and there were some massive projects that moved forward, things that we still are basic protections today, Social Security, the concept that just, after somebody retires that, that there is a basic level that we believe in human dignity, that everybody deserves a basic living standard. I think these are kind of principles that built this country, and this is what we have to get back to. And I think in Maryland, we have an opportunity to do it even more effectively than most other states because we have such a diverse economy. We have such a diverse set of offerings. We are a wealthier state than most. We have enormous gaps. There's no question. But I think here in the state, we have the chance to utilize our resources to make sure that everybody has a real shot, and that everybody gets a basic standard that we say, it is not all right for someone to live on the margins. We have to provide for the basics to make sure that everybody has a chance to maximize their own potential. And each different category, housing, employment, education, transportation, there are complex things that have to happen, but I think we have to start from the premise that we are building from new when we get through this. And I'm hopeful that the federal government can help lead the way. If they don't, then the state will have to continue to step up and fill that gap.
Well, Bill, you mentioned, and I thought you did a wonderful job in summarizing some of the potential positive outcomes of families being together. But when you did that, I was thinking immediately, again, of this whole equity issue. Because I was struck by you talked about how special it is that you and your children now are reading Harry Potter together. Nestor knows I've mentioned it on the show before. One of the things that I've enjoyed during this awful time is that I've got this little book club for my 9-year-old and my 10-year-old grandsons, and we're beginning the third book in a series of books by Neil Patrick Harris that are written for fourth to sixth graders. And it's been a wonderful experience, and I watch their vocabularies expanding, as I'm sure you watch your children's vocabularies expanding. What really troubles me, and I talk with my daughter, the principal, and what scares her to death is that those experiences aren't happening in every household, and this gap that troubles us all is getting bigger and bigger. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, we knew that gap existed pre-pandemic, right? I think one of the fundamental premises of the Blueprint for Maryland's Future, kind of the Kerwin recommendations, was this recognition that despite the progress that we've made in Maryland, huge gaps existed. And so the entire 10-year plan was built on how do we do a better job at targeting and closing those gaps and making sure that every child has access to a world-class school. One of the things that we didn't contemplate to the degree that I don't think we ever could have was the experience that we're now all facing with virtual learning, with this time period off. I mean, we as a society don't know what it's like to have 6 months off for an entire generation of kids. There is going to have to be some serious, serious work done on both identification of kind of the learning loss that's occurred and massive resources focused on kids that need it the most. This was a bedrock of Kerwin. I think it has to be even more a focus over the next, 3 to 5 years. There's going to be some serious learning loss that we know has resulted from this experience. It's probably going to be virtual in some ways moving forward in varying capacities. That wasn't contemplated when we passed this back in March. We're going to have to do some really important work to kind of expedite the level of engagement around virtual and learning loss and gap closing. But we can, and there are programs and resources that we can deploy, and we just have to make it a priority. I believe we will, but we just have to do the work to get it done.
Well, now, Mr. President, I need you to put your Senate President hat on. We've talked to some of your colleagues, and now it gets down and dirty. The governor vetoed Kerwin. As you know, Nestor and I have been passionate about Kerwin since day one, had you on to speak about it, the speaker on to speak about it. David Hornbeck on to speak about it. We've had all kinds of Kerwin advocates on. Wes Moore, right down the list. Governor's vetoed it, says we can't afford it. What do we do? What are the next steps? As I said to one of your colleagues, I'm not very optimistic. I want you to make me more optimistic that Kerwin isn't dead.
Oh, it's not dead. It's absolutely not dead. I think, are there going to have to be adjustments? No question. The world changed, the economic outlook. I think we have to be very realistic about the economic challenges that we face. But what's very important to remember is that money is a crucial part of the Kerwin recommendation in the blueprint, but it is not everything. It was the policies that were tied to the money that are as important, and the accountability and the oversight and sort of the basic expectation that every child deserves to be able to maximize his or her potential. That fundamental point is the seed that built Kerwin. And so that will continue to be more important moving forward than it's ever been. Now, there are a lot of external factors that could change. We could see some movement at the federal level for federal stimulus dollars to make up a lot of this lost revenue that state and local jurisdictions have experienced. If that comes through, we're talking about a very different picture of the world moving forward. We could have a new administration come November that understands the pains that states and locals are facing and has a federal program that really starts to invest in kids in a different way.
Well, that has to happen, right?
It has to. It absolutely has to. And at the end of the day, we will move forward. It is not going to be probably at the pace that we once hoped when we had a very different looking economy. I think we just have to be very honest about that. But we cannot afford to miss this moment. There is, from my perspective, and obviously I'm biased, there is nothing more important that we can do than get the education of the next generation done as effectively as possible. It is the single most important lever that we have in the public sector to radically improve society. And that has to be our priority moving forward.
Well, the governor was lukewarm, to say the least, on Kerwin from the beginning. The pandemic has now given the governor the bully pulpit on why we need to kill Kerwin. I would imagine there are senators in your chamber who were on the fence, who voted yes, who now feel they've been given the green light to switch to the other side and say, well, I really wanted it, but we just can't afford it. How do you, and this is part of that challenge, when you went to the big office, how do you put together the vote, and how do you pay for, how do you convince people that there's a way to pay for it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is why we do the job, right? It is a matter. This is why projections and prognostications and guesses about outcomes don't really matter. It's about getting the work done. We have to put forward the financial plan and show how we can pay for it. And I think we had done that. In fact, the bill that we passed, everyone said, "Oh, no way will there be Republicans that support it." In the Senate, we had six Republicans, including the minority leader, vote for that bill, joining all of the Democrats. Because what we came out with in the Senate was a piece of legislation that recognized this fundamental purpose. And Republicans and Democrats, education isn't a partisan issue. I think in a state like Maryland, we understand that the quality of public education is fundamental. It is the building block for a strong society. We'll do it again. I mean, we proved people who said there's no way Republicans would support it wrong by passing a bill that had six of the 15 Republicans on board. I am very confident that we will find a path. It's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take some really complex analysis. But we will move something that we can pay for, that we can afford, and that will set a brighter future for families across the state of Maryland.
Senate President Bill Ferguson joining us here. You said the economic challenges we face, the realities of that, as a citizen, break that down for me a little bit. When you think of the economic challenges we face, top five things that are going to go on in Annapolis over the next 12 to 18 months, provided we don't have another outbreak here, provided, let's say, we play football and baseball and things get normal and we get a vaccine in the winter.
If we get a vaccine in the winter, I think we're in a very, very different ball game. This will be it has been very intense, but if we have a vaccine by the winter, we'll be in a much, much, much better place. We will be able to kind of restart things at a faster clip. I'm hopeful that that's the case, but I'm also realistic. I think that we're going to see some continuing trend. I mean, if we see what's happened in Florida and Arizona and now California and Texas, this is not a simple solution. And so the results of that, particularly when the current federal programs run out, is we're seeing a significant downturn in sales tax revenue. We're seeing a significant downturn in withholding tax revenue, business licensing, new business creation and formation. We're seeing an increase in the costs associated with food for needy families and temporary cash assistance. So the costs are rising, the revenues are going down. This is sort of the basic tenets of any recessionary period. The question is how long that goes on. And the federal government plays an absolutely crucial role. As you all know very well, we have to balance the budget. We do it every single year. We're one of nine states that's maintained a AAA bond rating. So we will be financially reasonable. But by balancing the budget, it means that we can't borrow our way out of this. We have to use the resources that we have, which means we have to start prioritizing. The governor put forward cuts and the Board of Public Works made a $400 million cut. Those were painful. But right now, what we're looking at is a projection for our current fiscal year of $2.4 billion. So we did $400 million of $2.4 billion. That's not pretty if we don't see some upturning or some federal support. But we'll make our way through. We have in the past, and we will again.
Don, go ahead.
No. When we look at the whole picture, you mentioned some of the items before big on your plate were Preakness, Kerwin, HBCU. We touched a little bit on Kerwin. Can you bring our listeners up to date as to where we are on saving the Preakness and what we ended up doing with HBCUs?
Yep, so of the major bills out there, there were sort of four headliners. Kerwin, school construction, which was $2 billion of new school construction across the state. Dealing with a lawsuit that a coalition had filed against the state with our historically black colleges and universities, in which the state lost, and it is currently on appeal, and there were settlement negotiations trying to be worked out, and then finally Preakness. So of those four, the only one that made it through was the Preakness bill. That's the one that the governor didn't sign but let go into law. And so that one is presumably moving forward. A lot of the money that is associated with the Preakness comes from casino and gambling dollars. So there's probably going to have to be some alterations there because, as everyone knows, the casinos were shut down. That impacted the Education Trust Fund, but it also impacted the money that was going to go towards the reconstruction of those two tracks. But as far as I know, things are still progressing and negotiations are ongoing, so that one is sort of moving forward.
Well, it's all interconnected, isn't it, Bill?
Literally. It is, literally. HBCUs is a little bit more complicated, but fundamentally, this lawsuit stemmed from probably 16 years ago. The state was approving programs to the detriment that duplicated programs that were already at Maryland's historically black colleges and universities, put them at a disadvantage for enrollment. The state lost that case and said that there was essentially this program duplication created an inequitable burden on our HBCUs to be able to compete in the marketplace and put them at a competitive disadvantage. Certainly in the conversations that we're having now, this is something that should have been fixed a while ago, but we are where we are. The ideal solution here would be for the governor to negotiate a settlement that sets out a 10-year funding plan that allows HBCUs to compete in the new economy and offer programs that are unique, that allow them to really build out their program offerings. That negotiation had stalled, so the bill that we passed set up a fund that would allow for an investment in our HBCUs over a 10-year period. The governor vetoed that. You know, what I hope is that the governor, recognizing the challenges that we're facing, will try to re-engage in negotiations around a settlement with the HBCUs. I think the governor has a very extraordinary opportunity right now to lead on this front. We'll see how it progresses, but, you know, at the end of the day, if that's not something that happens, the legislature will step in, and we will find a way to solve this problem.
Well, Bill, I mean, as I said, governing doesn't stop just because of a pandemic. Anyone who's listened to this show knows that we have grave concerns about the ease of voting, not only in the state of Maryland, but across the nation. And the clock is ticking. And in Maryland, it was my understanding that the governor was going to have to make a decision by sometime early in July. The last time I checked, were early in July. I looked at the Board of Elections supervisors in the state, punted back to the governor. They didn't make a decision.
Well, it all went so smoothly 4 weeks ago, right, Don?
It was hard to count votes. Nestor knows that puts me over the edge. I don't understand why we have trouble counting votes every time. I've watched the process. I've been up close on the process. It really isn't that difficult, and we should be able to give the public a better process than what we have. So I guess when I turn to you now as one of the key members of governance in this state, what is the General Assembly doing to try to make sure that it's going to be easy for people in Maryland to vote? And where do you think this thing's going to land, Bill?
Yeah, so I think point number one, the most important point, is a decision needs to be made. It needs to be made yesterday.
We have
elections in November. This is an unbelievably important election. Local jurisdictions and the State Board of Elections need guidance on what type of voting is going to occur. That cannot happen effectively until a decision is made. The only person that has the authority right now under a state of emergency is the governor, and I have communicated with him, along with my chair, Paul Pinsky, of the Education, Health, Environmental Affairs. He oversees elections. We wrote a joint letter to the state board that we forwarded along to the governor. But the point is, a decision has to be made. Point two really revolves around one question. Are we mailing Marylanders the ballots, or are we mailing them an application to receive a mail-in ballot? Everything else out there is sort of noise. The state board put together three options: a traditional election, mailing of absentee applications, or a mail-in ballot where the ballot is affirmatively sent to all registered voters. Everyone agreed, Republicans, Democrats agreed, a traditional election is not possible. Take that off the table. If that is true, then we're saying there are going to be less polling places on Election Day and less opportunities for people to use their right of franchise. So then the question becomes, do we send them ballots to overcome those less polling places, or do we only send them an application where then they have to take another step to go request it, make sure that another piece of paper gets mailed to their house? To me, this is a no-brainer. If we're going to have less polling places, the only way to ensure people have the right to vote is to mail them a ballot.
Well, Bill, if I read, I want to jump in there and ask you to comment, because obviously people who have listened to us know that I 100% agree with you. There's zero examples for all of our listeners on the other side of the aisle. There just is no voter fraud. It doesn't exist. Let's just put that away. It's a myth, and that is something that truly is a hoax. There is no voter fraud. Now, having said that, the comments that I saw from some local Board of Election folks, Bill, was that one of the options that you mentioned, where people have to write in to request a ballot to get a ballot, is literally the clock has pretty much passed on that. That they don't have the manpower to be able to process another whole mailing to process who's asking for a ballot, then send it out.
This thing was poorly executed 4 weeks ago, and now the clock's ticking. It's only going to be more poorly executed unless there's more time, right?
Time is of the essence.
That's it. The election's not going to move no matter how much the orange guy is going to try to make it move.
Yeah. I mean, the decision has to be made. And even if it's the decision that what I would perceive as the wrong decision, I would rather just a decision get made, because we're putting these boards of elections in positions where we're setting them up for failure, because the time's going to run out. And so we need a decision first and foremost. But at the end of the day, the local boards and you know, if you look at the counties, we have a pretty diverse political makeup of our counties. The local boards of elections administrators, Republicans and Democrats, agreed we really should just send the ballots to everybody.
Right.
Do the mail-in, provide some in-person and early voting centers, but it's going to be reduced. It's easier on everyone. I am hopeful, and you know, I'm hopeful the governor will see that logic as well. But either way, we just need a decision.
Well, Bill, what is? Do you have any insight from the governor or his people? I'm having trouble. I usually try to think of whatever the political calculation could be. I'm having trouble getting my hands around why the delay on the part of the governor. What political equation is he trying to figure out here? Because I'm missing it.
I mean, I can imagine that the governor is looking at the November election, and there are going to be a lot of political wins in many different directions, and I can imagine that there is a desire to not make a decision that will jeopardize the integrity of the election. And so I believe fundamentally that must be the thing that is weighing on the governor's mind. But
in order to buy into that, Bill, thinking, you have to buy the premise that mail-in vote leads to fraud, for which there's no example to support that. Right?
I would agree with you. But, you know, with the generosity of spirit and believing the best of intentions of everybody, you know, should that be the belief, I guess the ultimate decision. You know, it just comes down to this question: do we mail in ballots or do we mail in applications? That's the question.
There's somebody who's been Senate president for a few months and has got the job well under control, well answered. Speaking of that, Bill, before we get to the national scene and the whole issue of monuments and all that, it certainly is impacting your district and others. I remember. As a young assistant principal, and I was blessed to have a principal who took me under his wing and really gave me every opportunity to experience every part of what being a principal was, from creating a schedule, to, you name it, soup to nuts, taking care of the building, signing substitute teachers, something as mundane as making sure lockers were ready for the new year. He made sure
students get into journalism classes when they show up, that sort of thing.
Everything on my plate. So that when I finally got appointed as principal, I thought, man, I'm ready. Mr. Dowsch has taken great care of me, took me under his wing here at Dundalk High. I'm ready to rock and roll now at Sparrows Point Middle School as the principal. There's nothing that's going to surprise me. Well, that nothing could have been further from the truth, because until you sit in the big office and it stops on your desk, you go, oh, okay, there was more to learn. So you had all kinds of good mentors down there. You watched the best Senate president in the United States of American history. What did you learn that you didn't know?
It would take too many podcast conversations to relay all.
That's
of
for
the
a crab cake
heard.
And Fadley's down the line.
Two or three things.
I would say something I knew, but I did not understand the extent of. I mean, this is a relationship business. At the end of the day, politics is about people, and the quality of one's relationship and the ability to build trust amongst unlike people with unlike interests is the name of the game, and so. The facts matter, data matters, reports and policy, all that matters. But at the end of the day, to really move something that's going to last, you have to build the coalition, and that means putting people together even when they often are on different sides. And so that one-on-one relationship, I've come to understand the value of that more than I ever imagined. The other thing I would say that I never could have quite appreciated are the number of issues that are flying at any given moment in which a decision is needed, yeah, from big to small. And that's something that I know I'd heard people talk about and read plenty of leadership books where you learn about, but until you're sitting there and the decision points are flowing one after the other, it is difficult to quite comprehend the how important it is to remain on point and not have throwaway decisions.
You know, Bill, was interesting that point right there, and Nestor, it may be true in running a business as well. That point that you just made was probably the key aha moment in my first year as a principal. I can remember I was standing in a parking lot after a meeting with a friend of mine who had been a principal for a number of years. I had probably been a principal all 4 or 5 months. And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, I can't figure out why I'm finding this so much more difficult than being an assistant principal was. I said, you know, as an assistant principal, I had a list of things that the principal assigned me to do. Don, mm-hmm. do the master schedule. Don, get the chaperone list ready. Don, make sure every kid's on a bus. And you'd go down and check, got that done. Check, got that done. Mm-hmm. Check, got that done. And all of a sudden, when you sit in the big office, I said to the guy, "There's no Don." And he said, "Oh, that's what's bothering you?" He said, "Take a deep breath. All of us who've been principals 5, 15, 20 years, it's never done, mm-hmm. and it always changes from minute to minute." And that was like, I remember
it goes from getting it done to I'd like to get it done, and I'm on the pathway.
I felt like a different person, and that's sort of what you're saying, is it's coming at you from all angles, and you realize it's never done.
Yes, and recognizing that I can't do it all, that... The importance of delegating accountably, and not owning every piece of the work. It's got to, those are, and I'm, you know, to this day, it's only been 7 months, but I would say that is a skill that I'm still trying to learn. It's hard to let go of things.
For all of us.
the ability to know when to delegate, how to delegate, all those things, well, certainly looks like you've mastered it wonderfully in the first session. Bill, you're a teacher, you're a legislator, you're a dad, you're a husband, you're somebody who loves the city. Make sense for us what you've seen in the wake of the killing of Aubrey Ahmad and George Floyd, and watching what's happening on the streets of America and in our nation's capital. Try to give us your perspective on what you think it means for our country.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for me to sort of start by recognizing that my perspective will never be able to fully appreciate the perspective of our fellow black and brown Americans, men, women, fathers, mothers, grandfathers, grandparents. You know, I try to take the perspective of, you know, as a dad, for my, is this the type of society that I want my children to feel comfortable in? But I will never have that personal experience of being a black father talking to his black son or daughter about an experience with a law enforcement officer. And I think I've tried to do a lot of listening. You know, that's how I've really tried to approach this. And this isn't new. I mean, I think Baltimore certainly faced a lot of this kind of reckoning experience in 2015 and forward. But there is a different scope and level of it. And I think it is interacted with this larger pandemic when we're having these conversations about equity, and you look at the housing disparities and health disparities and the impact that COVID has had on different communities and the lethality rate. You know, all of this stuff is interconnected. And so law enforcement is at the front and center. And I think it's the thing that rightfully, sort of as the spark that lit the match, is the thing that I think is in the front of everybody's mind. But it's not just law enforcement. And I think it'll be a mistake if we just look at it. We have to fix this issue of trust and belief in the social compact again. But we have to have the courage to take on the other issues, the housing disparities, the lack of access to capital, educational disparities. And this is going to take work and time. And I think that's the hardest part of this, is that there's no quick fix here. These are things that have developed over decades, over centuries. We have to be committed to making those changes now. And I believe I am. I believe we are, as a society, in a place that we are ready to start having these hard conversations. But it's going to take time, and we have to really examine what it is about our society and its structures that have created these perpetual disparities. And this is going to be an important moment. I think it will truly be generationally defining.
Bill, you talk so much about leadership and, you know, where you are and sort of finding your way into a new role. Certainly the whole notion, and I just got back from North Carolina, beach vacation with my wife. We kind of went down there to socially distance. Nobody's wearing a mask. And then you look up and see the red side and the MAGA hats and the hate rallies, and we're not going to wear masks. And I just, what we talk to our children about, right? And you were an educator of children, Don, same thing. Aside from all the economics of it, the science of it and where all that goes, just the leadership to how divided this has become, that we've politicized the plague.
Mm-hmm. It starts from the top. Yeah, I think if you look at other countries and the successes they've had, it starts from the top. And so we've seen really positive numbers in Maryland. And when you think about how Maryland approached this crisis, we really had a united front. We worked very well with the administration. Republican, Democrat, didn't matter. We were focused on the safety of Marylanders. And we are reaping those benefits right now. There is still enormous pain. I don't want to diminish that in any way. But we're in a very good place, and we've been consistently in a good place. And I think it's because it was a united leadership front. Nationally, though, that's not where we are. And I think this is hard outright. It makes it exponentially harder when we have such a vacuum of leadership. And in fact, not even a vacuum of leadership, antithesis of leadership that is happening at the top that just is pointing us in the opposite direction. It's why November really matters.
Well, it's really been an abandonment of leadership, literally,
yeah.
Right?
Well, but I think it's stimulating the opposite direction. So it's not just an absence. It's a stimulating an opposition to the
science,
practical steps that we can be taking to deal with this, that other countries are taking, that we know work. And when the person who is in that position doesn't use the information that is available to him or eventually her to make decisions, they're gonna find themselves in trouble. And I think that's where we are. And I do think that the country is starting to recognize that. And that does give me hope. Who knows what happens moving forward, but something's got to change at the top for us to find our way through this.
Don, are we about to let the Senate president go?
I was going to say, Bill, I really appreciate the update. I hope, these issues still to be decided. Hope we can have you on regularly to sort of give our listeners an update as to where the state is heading, important business ahead, and thank you for everything
Absolutely.
You're doing down there to fight the good fight.
Well, thank you all. Thank you all for telling the story, and we got a lot of work to do together, and I just keep hope alive, because we're going to do great things moving forward.
Appreciate the service, Bill. Thank you, my man.
Take care.
There you go, Senate President Bill Ferguson, 86th President of the Maryland Senate, serving us down in Annapolis, and a member of the Maryland Senate from the 46th District. That's local to you and me. Don Mohler, a former Baltimore County Executive, of course, always with us on Baltimore Positive. We're morphing our WNSD and our Baltimore Positive brands here and using our great, incredible local sponsors like our friends at State Fair and El Guapo over in Catonsville, those delicious Fadley's crab cakes. And we told the story where those Fadley crab cakes come from over on the Eastern Shore last week in a Baltimore Positive episode. Hope you check that out. And our friends, of course, at Taharka, awaken more than just your taste buds, made here in Baltimore, so you know it's got love in it. Just like our friends at Moeller and Gary Realty, dealing out those homes all over town with a mask on from 6 feet away. You can find them working out of Catonsville, working everywhere at Moeller and Gary Realtors. Also, you reach them at 410-489-2621. I'm going to have Jeff Moeller on next month as we hopefully cross our fingers, get back to baseball, maybe a little bit of football as well. We'll get back to the WNST.net side of things. On behalf of Don Mohler, I am Nestor Aparicio. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, calm, local, and Baltimore Positive.